Good day. This is Glenn. I'll be reading from the Cowboys and Indians magazine for the May-June 2023 edition. The story is Writing for the Brand, The Ballad of Bob Fudge. This cowboy saga, immortalized in song, comes from the true life adventures of a Texas trail driver and Montana-Wyoming cowboy who wrote it all down, by Ron Sudalter. The life of Bob Fudge tracks like a Jack Schaefer or Larry McMurtry novel. During the heyday of the big herds, he worked as a trail driver pushing thousands of head of cattle and horses north from Texas to the ranches and reservations of Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. He trailed through flooded rivers, waterless wastes, and stampeding longhorns and horses, and survived encounters with rustlers and hostile Comanches. In the decades following the end of the big drives, he stayed in the saddle, riding for the brand on the Great Northern Ranges. Robert George Fudge was born into a once prosperous Lampasas County, Texas family in 1862 during the early days of the Civil War. As he later told friend and author Jim Russell, who later published Fudge's recollections, "After the war, my people were left quite poor, and it was hard to get a start in Texas for a number of years." In 1872, the family, 10-year-old Bob, his parents, two brothers, a sister, two uncles, and four aunts, loaded all their possessions into four ox-drawn wagons. Driving 1,000 steers and 200 thoroughbred horses, the sale of which was to jumpstart their new lives, they turned their oxen's heads toward California. It would prove to be an unimaginably tragic journey, met with disaster almost from the start. The country across which they traveled was lawless and largely unsettled, with both white and Comanche raiders preying upon travelers. No sooner did the family cross into New Mexico than a band of Comanches descended upon them, killing one of Fudge's uncles and driving off the draft oxen and both herds, leaving the family with only four horses. Hitching them to two of their wagons, the Fudge party sought shelter in a small nearby settlement. Their situation rapidly went from bad to worse. The town was rife with smallpox, and within days the disease had taken Fudge's father, sister, two aunts, and his remaining uncle. The others, including young Bob, became desperately ill but eventually recovered. "This left my poor mother," Fudge recalled, "with us three little boys and one aunt." When she was able to travel, his resilient mother turned her much-reduced family around and returned to Lampasas. "I have admired the spirit which carried my noble mother across that wild, unsettled country without protection of any kind." The following spring, Fudge's mother settled a homestead neighboring the 33 Ranch, which belonged to Judge Taylor, a local justice. The judge hired 12-year-old Bob as a working cowboy, paying him a man's wage of $20 per month. "This was the beginning," Fudge noted, "of my work with the big cow outfits." Within 3 years, Fudge was breaking horses for the Esridge Brothers of Burnett County. Along with two fellow cowboys, he broke 100 horses in the fall season at the rate of three or four animals per day. "This horse breaking was hard, dangerous work," he recalled. "The horses at that time were as wild as deer, and some of them would pitch during their entire lives. Apparently, the horses that initially fought the hardest were the first to give up. One that would stand with his eyes half closed and pretend he didn't see a thing was one who would turn the world into rounds of glory." After delivering the Esridge mounts to stock contractors, Fudge went to work for the Higgins and Shanklin outfit, rebranding their wet horses, stock that had been stolen in Mexico and driven for sale across the Rio Grande. His bosses were putting together five herds comprising a total of 10,000 head of cattle for a northern drive, and Fudge helped with the sorting and branding. "I can remember herds leaving for the north and my wanting to go with each herd that left. The love for adventure that took young cowboys north was calling me, and my turn was soon to come." In May 1881, Fudge signed on as one of the drovers to deliver the last of the five herds to Hugo, Colorado. Fudge would later recall in conversations with friend and biographer Jim Russell that at this time, conditions on the trail were primitive at best. "In the way of equipment, we did not have much but a nickname and a good disposition. Those days, the rainproof tarpaulin was unknown to us cowhands. The cook's trials would madden a wooden Indian or a sweet-tempered saint. He had no tent to protect his reputation as a chef. He had nothing to work with but a couple of Dutch ovens and a sourdough barrel and a coffee pot. And for wood, he sometimes had nothing but a few weeds and swear words to keep the fire hot. We were almost 4 months with this herd of cattle, day and night, so it was a carefree bunch of cowhands who started for the sunny south that fall." At 19 years of age, Fudge was now an experienced cowhand. The following spring, he signed with the Blocker brothers to drive a herd of 2,000 steers north to the Little Bighorn River in Montana. He was one of a 12-man trail crew consisting of 10 cowboys, a horse wrangler, and a cook. During the period of the great cattle drives, legendary Texas cattlemen John R. and Abner P. Ab Blocker sent more herds north than any other cowmen. Fudge described Ab as the best trail boss that had ever brought cattle up the trail, and while Brother Johnny, as Ab called him, was responsible for the business end, both were exceptional cowboys. I have seen many good ropers in the South and in the North, Fudge recalled, but these blockers were the best men with a rope I have ever known. The herd that Fudge drove was only one of six or eight that the blocker sent north in that year alone. He was riding for the best in the trail driving business. At length, they came to Doan's Crossing on the Red River and the last chance for drovers to get mail and supplies before entering Indian territory. Although it was little more than an adobe supply depot, Doan's store was well known to every man who pointed them north. Described as the trail's last lonely Texas outpost, it stood at the edge of Indian territory, modern-day Oklahoma. When we crossed this river, Fudge recollected, we were at the very end of the world. The drovers were told to be alert to the presence of Comanches who still thought they owned this country, as we were soon to find out. The Comanches at this time were using poison arrows, made by milking a rattlesnake into a buffalo's or cow's liver until it was filled with venom, and then dipping their arrowheads in the organ. They took great care of their poisoned arrows, Fudge noted, and prized them next to their horses. At one point, the drovers were indeed confronted by a band of warriors demanding 100 of their best cattle to be cut from the front of the herd. They said that we were in their territory and that the white man had killed all their buffalo and they were going to have good beef in return. After a tense negotiation, during which they were offered some stock from the drags, mainly crippled and footsore beasts, the Indians galloped off, whereupon the cowboys corralled all their horses and prepared for an attack. We threw our bedrolls on the ground and everything that we thought would stop a bullet or an arrow or protect ever a part of our bodies. The Indians returned shortly, and to the crew's relief accepted the trail boss's offer. The men were soon to find out how fortunate they had been. A few days later, an army patrol entered their camp and informed them that this same band had recently come upon a five-man crew driving some 500 horses. They slaughtered the men and took the stock. Sure enough, that evening we saw the blood of those men on the rocks where the soldiers told us to look. Aside from Indian attack, there was no shortage of ways in which a cowboy could die on the trail. Contrary to Hollywood portrayals of the great cattle drives, gunplay did not factor significantly in the deaths of drovers. A cowboy could perish from stampede, blood poisoning, as happened to pioneer cattleman Oliver Loving and his fictitious Lonesome Dove counterpart Gus McCrae, pneumonia from passing cold nights on the wet ground, and being thrown by or dragged behind his horse. Lightning strikes claimed a fair number of drovers, as fellow Texas trail driver Edward C. Teddy Blue Abbott attested in We Pointed Them North, Recollections of a Cowpuncher. Lots of cowpunchers were killed by lightning, and that is history. I was knocked off my horse by it twice. Cowboys also faced the prospect of a lingering death resulting from intimate contact with soiled doves who sold their favors in the various cow towns. One of the more common causes of death among both men and horses was drowning. The long trail was laced with rivers, all of which had to be crossed. As Fudge noted, the crew had to log the chuck wagon whenever they came to a swimming river. This entailed tying two or three 16-foot logs to each side after securing the wagon box to the frame. The crew would then tie their ropes to the wagon and haul it across. Although it could take a full day, it was a vital operation. We could not let the flour and provisions get away, wet or dry, Fudge wrote. It was either protect that chuck wagon or not eat, and every cowboy knew it. The movies often portray both cattle and crew steadily swimming from bank to bank without incident. In fact, the process was frequently hazardous. Quicksand was a hidden peril, and when a river ran fast and high, it could turn hundreds of cows downstream, sweeping cowboys and horses along with them. By the time Fudge's crew reached the Arkansas River across from Dodge City, they had already forded several rivers without major mishap. Now, as the herd approached the river, several townspeople came out to watch the crossing. We generally picked a big, powerful horse for our swimming horse, as we called them, he recalled. I was a powerful swimmer those days and was not afraid of any river. At that time, I weighed under 160 pounds and was 6'3" tall and could swim like a muskrat. He set astride a big roan and all went well until he was about 50 yards from the opposite bank. At this juncture, the lead cattle got scared of the people who had come to see them swim. I kept trying to push them to the shore, but before I could get out of the way, I was surrounded with scared, mad, swimming cattle. They soon became so tightly pressed together that they got my horse under them. I let my horse go and grabbed horns, tails, or necks, anything to keep the cattle from getting me under them. I was an extra good swimmer, but I will never know how I made that bank. My horse was drowned. Despite Dodge City's reputation as king of the cow towns, Fudge was unimpressed. This place, Dodge, was beyond question the most lawless, most vile place at that time in creation. Still, it was a welcome diversion from trail driving, and the crew, in the words of Ab Blocker, as reported by Frontier Time magazine, planted dollars where they did the least good and yielded the most fun. At the same time, some of the crew were in town. Texas cattleman, saloon owner, and all-around scoundrel Prentice Print Olive was shot and killed by a young cowboy whom he had bullied. The youth then galloped to Fudge's camp, where the boss gave him one of our best horses, and one of our men gave him a six-shooter and a belt of cartridges. His cowboy heart was with the youngster. Apparently the drovers thought as little of Print Olive as did his killer. As Fudge and the crew continued north, they reached a barren, waterless stretch between rivers. They drove the cattle after sunset to spare them the brutal heat of the day. Still, for three brutal days, both cowboys and animals suffered. As an old man looking back in Fudge's memory, it was the worst suffering I have ever seen in my 70 years with cattle was on this drive from the Cheyenne to the Powder River. This suffering cannot be told in words. At night, their groans and the grinding of their teeth was the most horrible thing I have ever listened to. Upwards of 200 cattle died of thirst before the herd reached Powder River, and a tired, sore bunch it was. Water was abundant now, and after leaving the river, the Bighorn Mountains came into view. The drovers crossed the Tongue River and then the Little Bighorn, finally delivering their cattle to a ranch some 10 miles from the site of the battlefield where Custer and most of his men had fallen just 8 years before. Fudge had successfully completed his first trail drive to Montana. It was, he recollected, considered a fine trip at that time. Few trail herds had gone further north. The rancher who had contracted with the Blockers then delivered the cattle to the Flathead Indian Reservation. Fudge drew his pay and, along with his fellow drovers, rode down the Tongue to Miles City. Then, turning his horse south, I went home to my mother that fall in Lampasas County. I was quite a seasoned cowboy by this time. I had gone through the old school for cowboys, which was going up the trail from Texas to Montana. In 1884, Fudge hired on for a short drive to Charles Goodnight's far-famed J.A. Ranch in Palo Duro Canyon. Here he first saw a pasture girded with barbed wire. As he ruefully noted, Glidden had just introduced the barbed wire in Texas about this time, the wire that in less than 50 years has fenced and cross-fenced the West from Mexico to Canada. The following year, he signed on to drive a herd of 800 horses to the Pine Bluffs of southern Wyoming. "This was the wildest trip I ever made up the trail," he commented, sarcastically adding, "If a man is looking for romance, I would advise a trip up the trail from Texas to Wyoming with a horse herd. These horses stampeded night and day. We could run with them in the daytime, but at night all we could do was hope for the best. It was usually flirting with death to run in the lead of these horses at night, because horses that had been broken were more tractable and easier to drive than unbroken broncs. I and another cowboy broke horses all the way up with this herd." Fudge saw Montana again in 86. He began by helping to put up, sort and brand, five herds, each comprised of 2,500 two- and three-year-old longhorns, all to be sold on the northern ranges. The work was hard. Without branding chutes, it took two strong men to wrestle each animal to the ground. To assemble herds totaling some 12,500 cattle, contracts had to be taken with ranchers from a number of neighboring Texas counties, after which the five herds were each pointed north up the trail. By this time, the flow of Western immigrants had increased significantly, and the drovers encountered considerably more settlers than on previous drives. According to Fudge, relations were not always cordial. As to hospitality, those settlers were of a mixed temperament. Some of them would come out foaming mad when a trail herd would start across their little homesteads of 160 acres, while others would invite us to bed our herds on their land. These latter wanted the cow chips to burn. None of them were what we call hospitable. Ab Blocker himself was more colorful in describing the sodbusters. "That was a pretty hard set of people there at the time," he was quoted as saying in The Trail Drivers of Texas. "Every man you saw had a pistol and Winchester, and the children at the houses we passed were cutting their teeth on cartridge shells." This time the drive took Fudge and the herd north of the Yellowstone across the newly laid tracks of the Northern Pacific Railroad. "We had more trouble getting that herd across that track," he recollected, "than we had in swimming the Yellowstone River." This time the herd was delivered to a rancher who had contracted with the federal government to deliver the cows to the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. Fudge returned again to Texas, and the following spring he married and settled into a sedentary life. He built a home and a small ranch from which he bought and sold cattle. Life was idyllic for the next 7 years, whereupon his wife died. "In my great sorrow, I took to the wild trail life once more." He left his property with his brother and his only child, a son, with his in-laws. Taking only a cowboy outfit and the heaviest heart a cowboy ever had, I left for the XIT outfit, which was in the panhandle of Texas. The XIT was, in a word, vast. It was built in 1885 by a Chicago land and investment company. on 3 million acres acquired from the Texas state government at a cost of more than $1 per acre. It bordered New Mexico to the west and Indian Territory to the north. By the time Bob Fudge hired on in 1894, the ranch ran around 150,000 cattle. The managers were strict. They banned drinking, gambling, and stock abuse on the ranch and were not above hiring professional gunmen to discourage fence cutters and rustlers. Stock theft was an all-too-common problem among cattlemen at this time, and the Texas ranchers generally employed range inspectors, trail cutters as they were called, to inspect each herd south of the Red River and cut out any brand that did not belong. These trail cutters were men with a lot of nerve, Fudge commented. They all carried a Winchester on their saddles and a Colt 44 or 45 at their hip and were furnished with some of the best horses in Texas. One of Fudge's first assignments was to ride into Indian Territory to reclaim some XIT horses that had been spotted at a rustler's cow outfit there. Saddling a good horse, he rode to the ranch and alone confronted some 15 hard cases. They coldly assured him they had seen no XIT stock, and Fudge left without further discussion. That night, half a dozen or so of the rustlers followed his trail with mayhem in mind. Anticipating this, he had camped several yards off the trail and, pistol in hand, watched as they passed and returned. My gun was cocked at the first sound of them coming back, and I wiggled my trigger finger to be sure that it wasn't scared stiff, too. I decided not to sell out cheap, and if those outlaws had discovered me or my horse, they would have found my decision to be quite final. At daybreak, anxious to put as much distance as possible between the rustlers and himself, Fudge rode 25 miles before stopping for water. When he finally arrived at the XIT headquarters, I went to the manager and told my story. While he was measuring me with his eyes, I told him if he wanted those horses to go get them himself. To Fudge's recollection, no further effort was made to retrieve them. Shortly after Fudge signed on to the XIT, the owner started a small ranch in Montana. It was a wise initial investment. The northern ranges were ideal for raising cattle, and the rich grasses added hundreds of pounds to each of what Fudge called the poor, broken-hearted little fellows who left Texas, significantly increasing their market value. In the beginning, the Montana Satellite Ranch relied on the massive Texas spread for its stock, and Fudge soon found himself driving yet another herd of XIT cattle north. The trail which we traveled down Little Powder River went across the land which I own now, he later reflected. As we grazed those 2,000 steers down that river in 94, I never dreamed that someday I would have a comfortable home along that trail. All I wanted in those days was a job with a big cow outfit. This time, Fudge rode the train back to Texas in comparative comfort. In 1895, he signed on for his sixth and final drive trailing another XIT herd north to the Yellowstone. He was now 33 and considered old for a trail driver. When this herd was turned loose, I knew that I had made my last trip up the trail from Texas to Montana. The settlements were getting bigger and hard to get through, and the cattle companies were talking of shipping cattle from the south, which they did. The railroads had taken the trail. Rather than returning again to Texas, Fudge chose to make his home on the northern ranges. I had fallen in love with this Montana country that summer. He would ride for the northern XIT brand for the next 15 years, working as line rider, rep, roundup brand representative, wagon boss, assistant range manager, and all-around cowboy. His duties took him as far as north as Canada and as far south as northern Wyoming. Meanwhile, the approaching new century was bringing major changes to the western cattle business. Most significantly, cattle were now being shipped north on trains in a fraction of the time it had taken on the old trail drives with minimal loss of stock. But there were still herds together and dangerous rivers to cross. During one crossing, even with a bridge and ferry now in place on the Yellowstone, Bob's crew lost some 100 head of cattle. On another occasion, when denied use of the ferry, he had to swim his horse across the ice and slush-filled Big Missouri, emerging with my clothes frozen as stiff as though they were made of pine lumber. The remainder of Fudge's life was a solitary one. He never remarried, later telling friend and author Jim Russell that he would never find a woman who'd take the place of the girl he had married in Texas in the 80s. In 1897, Fudge received word that his young son, whom he had left with his late wife's parents in Texas, had died. When I read that sad letter, I was entirely broken up. I quit work for a while. The last link of my little home was gone. Ultimately, Fudge's job with the XIT ended. By 1910, the owners had sold off its cattle holdings, including its northern ranches. My home with them had been in the saddle over that vast country for so many years, but the loss of the company's operations was like losing a home to me. He later rode for a smaller outfit near Biddle, Montana, herding imported shaggy, resilient Scottish Highlander cattle. In the 12 years he rode for this ranch, I never hitched a team to a wagon, he recalled, or did any kind of work but ride. Telephones and cars had been introduced into the northern ranges. By 1915, telephones were commonplace, and one and 23 Montanans on an automobile. Fudge told the classic story of riding in his boss's new automobile on the way to town when a light snow turned into a blizzard. The car mired in the mud, whereupon a team of horses was brought along to extricate it. Fudge spent the last 9 years of his life living alone on his small ranch on Little Powder River, along with a small herd of cattle and his fine horses. There was never any class of people, he once told Jim Russell, who loved their horses more than the average cowboy. Russell, who knew and worked with Fudge for 20 years and would pen his biography, Bob Fudge, Texas Trail Driver, Montana Wyoming Cowboy, 1862 to 1933, wrote, "He never got away from the habit of always having a saddle horse under him." In 1933, less than a year after relating his experiences to Jim Russell, and after having lived most of his often perilous life in the saddle, Bob Fudge died as a result of a fall while he was afoot. He was 71. Perhaps the most fitting epitaph can be drawn from the final words of his memoirs. "If I were a young man and the West was a free, open world as it was in my youth, I would ask no better life than the one I have lived." Editor's note, memorializing in the month of May by Dana Joseph. In case your iCal isn't full enough, there's no lack of national days to observe and celebrate. On the day of this writing, it's simultaneously National Read Across America Day, National Old Stuff Day, National Walter Day, National Hospitalist Day, National Banana Cream Pie Day, and National Egg McMuffin Day. Pick any day of any month, and there's plenty to choose from to rally around and commemorate. May is among other designations: Great Outdoors Month, National Pet Month, National Mental Health Awareness Month, National Stroke Awareness Month, National Bike Month, and National Military Appreciation Month, all worthy things to honor. If you were to narrow the possibilities down to a manageable few days within May to focus on, you might go with a couple recognized by presidential proclamation: Mother's Day, the second Sunday, and Memorial Day, the last Monday. When Matt Crossman turned in his story about visiting Nez Perce country in Idaho, we knew we were in for a great read. One of our favorite longtime contributors, he's typically full of adventure and wit. This story was no exception, but it came with an emotional wallop, too. Without spoiling things, let's just say remembering mothers is one of the themes. It's not the first time Matt has shared about his mother. He and I lost our moms around the same time. Discovering this, we traded the eulogies it was our wrenching obligation to write. Are we ever more human than when we reveal just how much our mothers mean to us? Are we ever more vulnerable than when we lose them? Those of us who are mothers don't set too much store by a certain date on the calendar when there might be perfunctory presents. For me, it's a giant-sized Hershey's milk chocolate bar with almonds. The real deal is the recognition of that singular universal bond when it comes out in small gestures like phone calls from our kids, or in the occasional outpouring of unguarded love and heartfelt writing like Matt's River of a Mother's Love. Mothers know all about sacrifice, maturity, as well as a little purposeful reflection on Mother's Day, perhaps. Helps us realize just how much our moms do and have done for us. Sacrifice might as well be their middle names. So, too, our fallen heroes whom we honor on Memorial Day. Our moms fight for our well-being. Those who serve fight for our well-being in quite another way. They, too, lead lives of sacrificial devotion, and one calendar day a year that formally acknowledges that seems like paltry gratitude. Let us be thankful, then, for the month of May, for mothers everywhere, and for the men and women who have lost their lives so that we might live ours in freedom. There is glory in all of this. Happy trails. Burt Bacharach composed hundreds of chart-topping and much-recorded pop tunes, many of them with lyrics by collaborator Hal David, but likely remains best remembered by most Cowboys and Indians readers for the Oscar-winning Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, sung by B.J. Thomas in the 1969 Western Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Bacharach was 94 when he died in Los Angeles on February 8th. Kyle Jacobs wrote or co-wrote dozens of songs for such country stars as Garth Brooks, More Than a Memory, Trace Adkins, I Can't Outrun You, Randy Travis, Someone You Never Knew, and George Strait, When the Credits Roll. At age 49, he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound in Nashville on February 17th. Stuart Margolin co-starred with James Garner for 6 seasons in The Rockford Files, 1974 to 1980, after appearing opposite Garner in the TV western Nichols, 1971-72, and then was reunited with him in primetime for Brett Maverick, 1981-82. A short-lived attempt to reboot Garner's enduringly popular 1957-62 series, Maverick. Margolin's other credits include the films Kelly's Heroes, Death Wish, and The Gambler. He passed away at age 82 on December 12th in Staunton, Virginia. George T. Miller, not to be confused with fellow Australian filmmaker George Miller, with Mad Max and Fury Road, earned a mention in the Great Book of Westerns by directing The Man from Snowy River, the well-received 1982 drama inspired by Aussie writer Banjo Patterson's classic 1890 poem, which starred Kirk Douglas and Jack Thompson. Miller passed away February 17th in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. He was 79. Walter Mirisch formed the Mirisch Company in 1957 with his older brothers Marvin and Harold, then signed a distribution deal with United Artists, and the rest was movie history. Among the notable westerns to the company's credit, The Horse Soldiers, The Magnificent Seven, The Hallelujah Trail, Hour of the Gun, and The Spikes Gang. The Mirisch outfit also gave us three Best Picture Oscar winners, West Side Story, The Apartment, and In the Heat of the Night. Walter Mirisch died February 24th at age 101 in Los Angeles. Stella Stevens gave one of her finest performances as a sympathetic prostitute in love with a feisty stagecoach station operator, Jason Robards, in Sam Peckinpah's The Ballad of Cable Hogue, 1970. She also starred in the 1964 comic Western Advance to the Rear and the 1971 spaghetti western A Town Called Hell. Stevens passed away February 17th at age 84 in Los Angeles. Raquel Welch earned her spurs while riding alongside James Stewart and Dean Martin in Bandolero, 1968, and Jim Brown and Burt Reynolds in 100 Rifles, 1969. In 1971, she starred as the title character in Burt Kennedy's Hanny Calder, playing a frontier wife who becomes a vengeful gunslinger after three outlaws, Ernest Borgnine, Jack Elam, and Strother Martin, kill her husband, then rape her and leave her for dead. Welch also portrayed a fiercely independent, Pikuni Blackfoot woman in the 1980 TV movie The Legend of Walk's Far Woman. Welch was 82 when she died February 15th in Los Angeles. Influential Indigenous by Johnny D. Boggs. We talk with Owen Wister Award recipient Joseph M. Marshall III about some pressing issues in Indian country today and notable Native Americans whose influence has benefited and exemplified Native people. Joseph M. Marshall III can be intimidating. Like many Lakota men, he's tall, lean, strong, with probing eyes that don't miss anything. This Oglala Sinkangu Lakota doesn't have to shout to get his point across, and he isn't one to hold back on what he thinks. He's also respectful, honest, witty, and often hilarious, and he's one of the best Native writers at work today, writing fiction and nonfiction about Lakotas, which is why on June 24th in Rapid City, South Dakota, not too far from where Marshall was born, Western Writers of America is giving him the Owen Wister Award for Lifetime Contributions to Western Literature. Previous honorees include Pulitzer Prize winners N. Scott Momaday and Louise Erdrich, historians Eve Ball and Robert M. Utley, Cherokee scholar and novelist Robert J. Conley, and bestselling novelists Rudolfo Anaya, Elmore Leonard, and Tony Hillerman. Marshall will also be inducted into the Western Writers Hall of Fame housed at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. Though our paths had crossed mostly at literary soirees, I first really got to know Marshall when he asked me to moderate a Q&A with him at a 2012 book signing for The Lakota Way of Strength and Courage, Lessons in Resilience from the Bow and Arrow. I learned more about Lakota life from reading that book and handling that Q&A than I had from reading scores of other books. But I didn't drive from Santa Fe on a pleasant December day to Hatch, New Mexico, where Marshall has been recovering from a recent illness, to congratulate him on his latest honor. I wanted to get his take on the state of Native affairs and to learn his picks for today's 10 most influential Native Americans. I arrived late, though no fault of my own. A washed-out road, this is New Mexico after all, forced me to find an alternate route. But I reached the house where he has been staying with his first editor. The way she tells the story, he walked into the Casper, Wyoming Star Tribune and told her that the newspaper needed a column on Native issues and he should write it. He got the job. Well, it's not easy to tell Joe Marshall no. We haven't seen each other since 2016 when he gave a keynote address at the WWA convention in Cheyenne, Wyoming. He's slightly thinner, the short dark hair showing more gray, but he looks fit and comfortable, dressed in blue jeans, a blue button-down shirt, jean jacket, and loafers. He also has a visitor, a young Lakota woman driving back home to South Dakota. She wants to listen to part of the interview before hitting the road. Born in 1945, Marshall grew on South Dakota's Rosebud Reservation, where he was raised by his grandparents, who kept him out of school until he was 8 years old. He spoke Lakota and didn't learn English until he finally attended school. "I ran away from school a lot," he says. "I didn't like that place." That voice hasn't changed, friendly but commanding. He often narrates audiobooks of his works. I love listening to those as much as I enjoy reading his prose. But he didn't quit. By high school, he was writing, I would write down what my grandparents told me, stories about our people, what they knew about history, cultural stories. I would write those just so I could remember them. After high school and college, he taught Native Studies and Lakota language and served in administrative positions with the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He was one of the founders of the Sente Gleska University on the Rosebud Reservation. In 1992, Soldiers Falling Into Camp, The Battles at the Rosebud and the Little Bighorn, co-written with Robert Kamen and Frederick Lefthand, was published. Marshall hasn't stopped since. The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, A Lakota History, was a 2008 Penn Beyond Margins Award winner. The Long Knives Are Crying About the Battle of the Little Bighorn was a 2009 WWA Spur Award finalist for Best Western Long Novel. The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living, was a 2002 Penn Center USA West Award finalist. When writers get together, we talk books. I ask if you ever read Mary Sandoz's biography, Crazy Horse, The Strange Man of the Oglalas, first published in 1942. He did, thought it was okay, but relied too heavily on white accounts. That's one reason, he says, he wanted to rework his first book and why The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn followed white and native perspectives of the battle. I read Sandoz, I tell him. I read Kingsley Bray's Crazy Horse, A Lakota Life, the 2007 Spur Award winner for Best Nonfiction Biography. But it wasn't until I read Your, The Journey of Crazy Horse, A Lakota History, in 2004 that I truly understood Crazy Horse. There's that smile again. He thanks me, and it's time to break for lunch. His visitor takes her leave and heads out, and we take my truck to the Pepper Pot, a longtime Hatch institution, to get our New Mexico green chili fix. When was the first time you ever ate Mexican food, I ask. He laughs. Okinawa. My jaw drops. The story gets even stranger. A Japanese couple ran the place he happened by while exploring a small Okinawan village. I'd never smelled anything like that, he recalls. I think I ate everything they made. I've been eating it ever since. Full of green chili and iced tea, we return to the house and get to the serious stuff. He champions native rights. I'm American, he says, but I am Lakota first, culturally, spiritually, by heritage. Are things better for native peoples today? Depends on the mood I'm in when you ask, he says. I'm going to say no, because all you have to do is go on Facebook and look at posts. I bring up three critical concerns facing many natives. Missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. The problem of missing indigenous women and girls is so shockingly prevalent it has its own acronyms, MMIW, MMIWG, and groups dedicated to working on the issue. It's been a shocking reality for a long, long time, but the public and Hollywood were slow to react. But now it's become a plot line in movies including Wind River and TV shows like Alaska Daily and Showtime's docuseries Murder in Bighorn. Marshall's current novel in progress looks at the often unreported disappearances of Native women. It's been going on for a long time all across Indian country, he says, and certainly the Bureau of Indian Affairs is not, in my perspective, paying enough attention to it. They're not devoting enough sources to it. All people who care, all the agencies, and all the organizations need to stand up and try to resolve the problem. Boarding school trauma. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland has been overseeing a Road to Healing tour for victims and survivors of abuse at so-called Indian boarding schools established to assimilate Native youth into white culture by methods such as cutting children's hair, preventing them from speaking their own language, and practicing their religion. We have a long way to go, Marshall says. I think for the most part, there's still somewhat of reluctance to bring it all to light. To admit that what happened with boarding schools, both the parochial and the government schools, was a travesty and was certainly wrong. I find it hard to believe, but perhaps maybe what society was trying to do had some semblance of good intent. But that's hard for me to say. It's hard for most Native people to say that. Whatever the motivation was, what they inflicted is still being felt today. That trauma was handed down over generations. I'm reminded of the 9 remains that were brought back from Carlisle, a Pennsylvania boarding school from 1879 to 1918, to Rosebud Reservation a couple of years ago to be reburied. That helped to a certain extent. At least we brought them home where they belong, so that's part of the healing process. More of that sort of thing has to happen, but it has to begin with the government and white society saying this was a bad thing and what can we do to help you heal. Crime on reservations. Tribes still have complete jurisdiction only over non-major crimes involving only Native victims and Native perpetrators, and federal agencies seem to focus only on high-profile cases. Nothing has changed since the Major Crimes Act, enacted in 1885 for Native tribes, Marshall says.
In some ways, tribes can't prosecute non-natives who commit crimes on tribal land. So that's one issue which is particularly hard, but I think they can change laws and regulations. That falls into the lap of Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Justice, and other agencies. Can this change? I ask hopefully. I hope so, Marshall says. We're in charge of our own education, so that's a step in the right direction. We talk throughout the afternoon and make a good start on the purpose of my visit, to find out who Marshall would name to a list of 10 influential indigenous people. Our enjoyable conversation in Hatch will continue over the phone and email until he eventually settles on his list. His 10 choices of influential natives show that some things have changed for the better. When I was asked to choose 10 influential native indigenous people, I decided to focus on the word influential and not the extent of fame or celebrity, although some have accomplished some level of that in their chosen endeavors and disciplines. I chose to focus on the kind of influence they wielded and how it directly benefited and exemplified it. Native people. On the list are athletes, lawyers, performers, educators, poets, and writers. Each of them, by choice or by chance, entered fields of endeavor or occupations that were mainstays of white America and excelled. In my opinion, they excelled not because they became versions of white Americans, but because they exemplified and applied the strongest virtues and abilities of native people. Some on the list are known worldwide, some only in this country or only in their own communities, but each of them had an impact in at least two ways. One, they set an example for other native people to follow, and two, they demonstrated to the white mainstream that natives are as capable as anyone. Each of them likely found themselves facing an opportunity, knowing that failure would be a judgment against their kind and of themselves individually, but they did not shirk the challenge. They might have at times stumbled and failed, but they persevered, and in doing so, they exhibited the most powerful influence of all. Leadership by example. Each of them has my admiration and respect. Joseph Marshall's 10 Influential Indigenous, presented in alphabetical order. Charisse Davids, Ho-Chunk. A U.S. representative from the 3rd District in Kansas, elected in 2019, she became one of the first two indigenous women, along with Deb Haaland, to serve in Congress. An attorney, she focuses on economic and community development and making health care more accessible and affordable to everyone. She's also a former mixed martial arts fighter, which is a very difficult thing for a Native person to do, Marshall says, and especially a Native woman. Charisse Davids participated quite well in a non-Native-dominated sport. Number two, Louise Erdrich, Turtle Mountain Chippewa. A writer of Native American literature and children's books, she is best known as an award-winning novelist from her first 1984's Love Medicine to 2021's Pulitzer Prize-winning The Night Watchman. Her work explores her Native ancestry and cultural issues confronting modern-day Native Americans. She also owns Birch Bark Books and Native Arts, an independent bookstore in Minneapolis. She's a great writer, Marshall says. I like her novels, and she's a businesswoman. Number three, Donald Fixico, Sac and Fox. A writer, ethnohistorian, and distinguished foundation professor of history at Arizona State University, Fixico is also the founding director of the Center for Indigenous Nation Studies at the University of Kansas. He's a widely respected thought leader and intellectual who writes about the Native American experience in history, especially in the West, often focusing on indigenous urbanization, as in his books, The Urban Indian Experience in America, 2000, and The Indian Resilience and Rebuilding, Indigenous Nations in the Modern American West, 2013. He also served as a cultural and heritage advisor for the innovative new First American Museum in Oklahoma City, where his insights, contrasting the linear thinking of Western culture and the holistic, nonlinear, circular ways that Native Americans view the universe, helped guide the design team. He made sure that the Native perspective and Native representation are there, Marshall says. That's not always the case. He's a very strong leader in that respect. Number four, Deborah Haaland, Laguna Pueblo. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland was confirmed on March 15, 2021, the first indigenous person to hold the post and the second Native to hold a cabinet position. As Interior Secretary, she has oversight of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. She was previously a U.S. Congresswoman representing New Mexico's 1st District. She earned a bachelor's degree in English and later a Juris Doctorate. She represents what a lot of Native women go through as single mothers, Marshall says. She started her own business to support herself, and President Biden didn't just put her up for the job because she was a Native. He did it because she was qualified for the job. Some of her top priorities include renewable energy and conservation, climate change, and environmental justice, missing and murdered indigenous women, and government-to-government relationship with sovereign tribal nations. Number five, Joy Harjo, Muskogee. A teacher, musician, poet, playwright, and author, Harjo served three terms, 2019 to 2022, as the 23rd Poet Laureate of the United States. She is the author of 9 books of poetry and 2 award-winning children's books, and she plays the saxophone. I admire anybody who can do what they do and enjoy it, Marshall says, and she's a poet. Poetry is something that terrifies me. I don't write poetry, but it's a unique way to express yourself, and she does that very well. Eldon Marshall, Sinkangu, Lakota. Marshall, a high school teacher and coach at White River, South Dakota Public School, has taken his boys' Class B basketball team to the state tournament a record 13 consecutive years, won the tournament twice, and picked up his 400th career victory this season. He's not just a coach, he's a great teacher, Joe Marshall says, and he's had a lot of influence on his players, not just in basketball, but beyond. Number 7, Billy Mills, Oglala, Lakota. The 3-time NCAA track champion and Olympic gold medal winner from the 1964 Tokyo Olympics co-founded a nonprofit that advocates for Native youth. Through Running Strong for American Indian Youth, Mills devotes his efforts to empowering and encouraging Native young people to follow their dreams. As the organization's national spokesperson, he travels more than 300 days a year, visiting Native American communities around the country, talking to kids about living healthy, and taking pride in their heritage. He was everybody's hero, and he certainly was mine, because I was in high school when he won the gold medal, Marshall says. You aspire to be like someone like that. The fact that he was Lakota is, of course, the ultimate kind of model for someone like me. Number 8, Debbie Reese, Nambi Pueblo. This educator founded American Indians and Children's Literature, which works to ensure the accurate representation of Native people in children's literature. She worked on adapting Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's An Indigenous People's History of the United States to young people. What I like about her, Marshall says, is that she's gearing all of her efforts toward children and young people so that literature for Native people reflects on them and that they learn that it's authentic, it's true, it's real. There are few people like her. Number 9, Virginia Driving Hawk Sneeve, Sinkangu, Lakota. Since 1970, the 90-year-old award-winning author has published more than 20 books on Native history, nonfiction, fiction, and poetry for children. She spent 40 years teaching English and serving as a counselor at Rapid City, South Dakota Public Schools and at the Flandreau Indian School. President Clinton presented her with a National Humanities Medal in 2000. She was putting out children's book about Natives when that was not happening a lot, Marshall says, and she added a lot of role models for young readers in those stories. Number 10, Wes Studi, Cherokee. The well-known award-winning actor has appeared in many mainstream films such as Dances with Wolves, Last of the Mohicans, and Geronimo, an American Legend. Before finding those roles, Studi served in the Vietnam War and advocated for Native rights. Marshall, as a technical advisor, worked with Studi on the TNT miniseries Into the West. He was a very good actor, a consummate actor, Marshall recalls. You could see that about him right away, how dedicated he was, how good he was at his craft, and he was a very personable guy. Cowboys and Indians cover story, Lou Diamond Phillips. On the eve of his induction into the Hall of Great Western Performers, the multi-talented star chats about iconic screen roles, creating for the stage and the page, and following his passions down new pathways by Joe Layden. Lou Diamond Phillips offered me a hearty handshake and a heartfelt apology for being a few minutes late for our lunch at Sardi's, the storied New York Theater District restaurant where the walls are festooned with caricatures of past and current Broadway stars. But really, he had a good excuse. He was checking out his final edit of the episode of East New York that he had directed, one that was slated for airing in less than a month's time. There had been trouble with occasional rain during the on-location filming, he explained as the waiter neared our table, and that had forced director, cast, and crew to revise and improvise on the spot. In the edit, however, it had all come together smoothly, even a tricky scene in which two key characters managed to complete an extended outdoor dialogue without their umbrellas bumping together. And now he was ready to celebrate a little. "I'll have a martini, Phillips," he told our waiter. "A dirty martini. 3 olives. Hey, he's entitled." And as we toasted, I noticed that as I'd requested in our email exchanges, Phillips had indeed asked when he made reservation that we'd be seated at a table below his very own caricature, which had been added to the Sardi's Walls of Honor when Phillips wowed critics and audiences as a lead in the 1996 Broadway revival of The King and I. So, of course, after we toasted each other, we mock toasted the picture and then asked the waiter to take a photo of us pointing at the picture. Trust me, celebrity interviews don't always begin on such a festive note. Come April, Phillips will receive an honor of a different sort. He'll be inducted into the Hall of Great Western Performers at the 62nd Western Heritage Awards by the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City. The tribute serves as admiring recognition of the actor's memorable performances in such films and TV productions as Young Guns, 1988, and Young Guns 2, 1990, in which he played outlaw Jose Chavez as Chavez. The Dark Wind, 1991, an adaptation of Tony Hillerman's novel that cast him as Navajo police officer John Chi. The Trail to Hope Rose, 2004, a Hallmark Channel Sagebrush saga, co-starring Ernest Borgnine and Lee Majors. Lone Rider, 2008, a made-for-cable odor with Phillips' ex-soldier battling Stacy Keach's corrupt land grabber. Angel and the Bad Man, 2009, a surprisingly satisfying remake of the classic John Wayne movie with Phillips impressively subbing for the Duke. Big Kill in 2019, a serial comic shoot-em-up featuring Phillips as a notorious gunslinger with an impeccable fashion sense. And Longmire, the 2012 to 2017 series, based on Craig Johnson's novels that featured Phillips as Henry Standing Bear, the supportive friend of Sheriff Walt Longmire, Robert Taylor, and proud operator of the Red Pony Saloon in continual soiree. Phillips, a Filipino-American actor born in 1962 at the Subic Bay Naval Station in the Philippines, dates his roots in westerns back to his youth in Texas. While attending Flower Bluff High School in Corpus Christi and University of Texas at Arlington, he worked as a fry cook at the quintessential Texas restaurant, Whataburger, and met a genuine Texas superstar during his employment as breakfast cook at a Padre Island surf shop. My first brush with fame was making a Denver omelet for Willie Nelson, who had the munchies at 9 in the morning. Imagine that. And so it was most important omelet of my life. As Phillips' career has endured and prospered from his breakthrough in La Bamba, 1987, to his recent work on both sides of the TV cameras, so have his culinary ambitions. He laughs when addressed as a foodie, but readily agrees it has come a long way from burgers and fries. I was already good at cooking when La Bamba happened, he said. And as I started traveling all around the world, eating at really great restaurants, I started asking questions and picking up things. And I think when it really, really sort of took off for me was in 1990 when Bobby De Niro asked me to be partners at Tribeca Grill here in New York. I was like, hey, I'm in. And all of a sudden, I'm a restaurateur. I remember when I told my business manager I wanted to invest in this thing with De Niro, he goes, Lou, restaurant, bad idea. Well, you don't understand. When I die, I can put I was Bobby De Niro's partner on my tombstone, so I don't care if I lose the money or not. And yet, here we are, what, 30-something years later? Phillips has made New York his home base since moving here for the 2019 to 2021 run of the TV drama Prodigal Son. He and his wife, Yvonne Bosmier Phillips, drove across country in one of those vans that the bands rent. We came over with my daughter, who was at the end of 11 at that point. She's 15 now. And five cats and a dog, which is why we drove. It's possible, Phillips says, that the family may return to La La Land or thereabouts sometime in the future, depending on what and where future employment offers arise. For the time being, however, he's perfectly content to be a New York homebody who occasionally acts, or directs, or writes. He's already at work on a follow-up to his 2020 debut novel, the sci-fi fantasy The Tinderbox, Soldier of Indira, or to enjoy the occasional lunch at Sardi's. CNI, you're going to be joining some pretty stellar company in April when you're inducted into the Hall of Great Western Performers, but you've certainly earned your place in the Pantheon. What is there about Westerns that appeals to you? Lou Diamond Phillips, they are the American version of the parable of the morality tale, Aesop's fables, Grimm's fairy tales, even the parables of the Bible. At their best, they bring about this finite world where questions of character and morality and nobility matter. Cowboys are the knights of the American mythology, and I love that. CNI, and you've gotten paid to play cowboy. Pretty sweet deal. Phillips, it's so funny. In Westerns, I've quite often been the native point of view, which I'm very proud of. But yeah, whether it's Lone Rider or The Trail to Hope Rose or one that I really loved, Angel and the Bad Man, I got to be the cowboy and espouse a lot of virtues that you try to live by. As an actor playing those characters, when you're doing that research, when you're thinking through these characters, it's like, wow, I hope that's who I am. That honesty, that integrity, I'd like to be that kind of friend that Henry Standing Bear is to Walt Longmire. And yet also the kind of friend who can stand pat and go, you're wrong, or no, this is what I believe, so I got to stand by that. CNI, do you have a favorite Western? Phillips, one of my favorite films of all time, and it's funny because the poster hung in Henry Standing Bear's office in Longmire is Little Big Man. I mean, that is epic, man. That's like Canterbury Tales or something. I mean, it's the story of this person who goes through all this history. He was the original Forrest Gump. If you can believe Young Guns 2 producer, screenwriter John Fusco, and really there's no good reason why you shouldn't, Lou Diamond Phillips is the kind of collaborator you always want on your movie set. Lou's an entertainer, he said during a recent CNI interview. He's the real deal. He's kind of a throwback. I remember one night when me, Emilio Estevez, pretty much all of us were down on the Mexican border in a little cantina drinking tequila with James Coburn. Lou, true to his discipline, wanted to get to bed to be ready for the early shoot. He was first up, and as he left the table, he stood up and he said, "Good night, everybody." And then he said, "Mr. Coburn, what a privilege and honor it is to be working with you, to be at this table with you, to hear your stories and your history. You blazed the trail for us, and you're the real deal, and such a class act, and the rest of us are mumblers just trying to live up to your level." And I remember James got all teary-eyed. He was kind of left speechless. He just said, "Well, thank you, Lou. That's the kind of guy Lou is." Unfortunately, Fusco's memories of working with Phillips on Young Guns 2 aren't uniformly happy ones. "We were in Galisteo, New Mexico," he said, "and we were shooting the escape from the pit scene, and there's fires, and Chavez and Doc, Kiefer Sutherland, have nooses around their necks. So Lou was riding his horse, and all this was a night shoot. Well, his horse had fallen asleep, like most of us, and the blanks that were fired were large loads, and I don't think they were supposed to be. It wasn't a rust situation. There was never a firearms accident on any of the Young Guns movies, which I'm proud of, but we fired a pretty large load of blanks, and it woke the horse up, and he spooked and took off with Lou on him and threw Lou. Things went downhill after that. If he had just been thrown, it wouldn't have been so bad, but he was hanging from the noose, and it was supposed to be a breakaway noose, but it wasn't, and the horse dragged him through wood piles, windows, whatever. I had actually gone out to grab some dinner. When I came back, there was a medical helicopter leaving the set, and I remember jumping out and asking someone, 'What happened?' He was like, 'It's Lou, it's Lou. He's in serious condition.' I was like, 'Oh, my God,' and he wound up having 9 screws in his arm. And if that weren't bad enough, because of Phillips' injuries, director Jeff Murphy was not able to shoot a planned opening sequence that would have reintroduced the actor as Jose Chavez A. Chavez, the same character he played at the previous Young Guns. We'd meet Chavez," Fusco said, "and he was in a Navajo village. Lou loved that scene, but..." C&I, "So after that accident on the Young Guns 2, were you reluctant to get back in the saddle?" Phillips laughs. "Oh, I still ride. I still do, and I still get sore in places where I'm not aware of until I get on a horse. But yeah, I had that major accident on Young Guns 2. Got dragged, broke this right arm in 4 places, took a chunk out of my kneecap." C&I, "And that's when you start thinking, maybe I could go back to flipping burgers at Whataburger." Phillips, "Exactly. Or stop doing my own stunts like an idiot, although Tom Cruise hasn't taken that advice yet, so God love him. But yeah, I've continued to ride. I rode a couple of times in Longmire, some beautiful shots, actually. That one season opener in the snow was gorgeous. Cold as freaking all get out, but gorgeous. And there's a number of the westerns that I did for Hallmark where riding was important." C&I, "I'm sure I'm not the first person to tell you this, but I much preferred Young Guns 2 to the first Young Guns." Phillips, "I agree with you a lot. I love the second movie. We set out to make a classic western in the second one, and Fusco says the same thing. We shot a big screen. It was a little more epic. Here's a little tidbit that's frickin' mind-blowing. James Horner did the score for Young Guns, but Fox fired him and replaced him with whoever those guys were. And they did this synthesized rock and roll score that I hate to this day, because they wanted the MTV influence. And so that's what we got wrong in the first one. But then in the second one, it was like, 'All right, man, let's go old school. Let's go classic.' And it's a much more classic film. But you know, both of those films hold up, and they're entertaining to this day. And you can't say the same thing about every film that came out in 1988 or 89. You know what I mean?" Craig Johnson vividly recalled what made him think right from the start that Phillips would be the perfect choice to play Henry Standing Bear in the TV series based on his Longmire novels. "Whenever I saw the DVD of Lou doing the audition for Henry," Johnson said during a call from his Wyoming home, "he dropped all the contractions. There were contractions in the scene that they had written for the audition, but he dropped the contractions. And in my books, Henry doesn't speak with contractions. So I knew when I saw the audition. He's read my books, and he actually had it. He had heard that." The TV show was based off a series of books, so he went out and grabbed, I don't know, 2 or 3 of the novels and read them over the weekend before he came in and did the audition for Longmire, which is really wonderful. He's a voracious reader, which is not something you can say about all actors. Johnson's enthusiasm dimmed only a bit when he realized that at that time Phillips was younger than the Henry Standing Bear in his neo-Western mystery novels. On the other hand, Robert Taylor, the actor so perfectly cast as Sheriff Walt Longmire, also was younger than Johnson's literary creation. "The biggest conflict that I ever had with the producers," the writer said, "was when they said, 'We're thinking about making Walt and Henry about 10 years younger than they are in the books.' And that's when I had the immediate cowboy redneck response where I was like, 'Well, now, why are we doing that?' And they said, 'Well, because we'd really like the show to run for about 10 years, and we'd rather not have Walt and Henry on walkers by the time we get through to the end of the show.' So I had to just shut up again and say, 'Well, okay then.'" CNI, a final question. Over the years, you have made films, including the Young Guns movies, where you played opposite fine actors and the magic didn't happen for them. Their careers just didn't go beyond a certain level. Why you? Phillips, that's a really interesting question. Wow, that is a really interesting question. CNI, please don't misunderstand. I don't mean that to sound like, hey, how the hell are you making a living? Phillips, laughs. No, I have to ask myself this sometimes, and it's interesting. Let me couch this in terms of where we're at in 2023. I was raised to be humble, whether it's not my military background through my father or the Asian background. You don't toot your own horn. That was crass. Now we find ourselves in an era of blatant self-promotion to the point where you have people making up resumes that don't exist. I'm the best at this. I'm the best you've ever seen. To me, this is still offensive to my core. But I will say this. I remember one review of a really bad film where it said, Lou Diamond Phillips is acting like he's trying to earn an Oscar. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly right. If I say yes to a role, you got my best. For whatever reason, I took the film, and there have been many that I've taken where it's like, okay, there's a ceiling on this. It's only going to be ever so good. And unfortunately, usually it went in the other direction. And then it's like, okay, it's not even going to achieve the best that it can achieve. It's just going to be a piece of programming. But I cannot walk through a role. I will not do it. It is not part of who I am. I will give everything that I have to the role if I've said yes to you. CNI, and when you're fortunate enough to be associated with something like Longmire, Phillips, it was amazing to see the staying power Longmire has. It was canceled 6 years ago, and people are still binging all six seasons. You can look at it today, and it's still a great series. And I think that's the one thing I've learned after all these years, after doing La Bamba, Stand and Deliver, and the Young Guns movies. If your intentions are pure, and if you go in and you do the best work that you can do, you try to make the best film that you can make, give the best performance you can give, you're aiming for classicism. You're not aiming for what's trendy. You're aiming for the long run.